In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I discuss 7 steps to rescuing a failing software project. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 132. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Mike?
Well, last week I interviewed a bookkeeper, and the hope is that I can basically hand off all of my bills and credit cards and, you know, my books and everything and just not have to worry about any of it and free up some of my time every month.
That is a very good idea. Are you doing it for your personal accounts or for your business accounts?
Technically for my business, but if it works out, then I may very well say, hey, can you also do these books as well?
Yep. So I'm looking into this exact thing, actually. Since Indinero hasn't worked out, and I have a pretty complex system and a lot of rules that need to be put in place, and I haven't been able to find an online source to handle it, I think I'm also going to be hiring someone to handle it. It's too much work, and it's work that doesn't move your business forward at all.
Yeah, I just feel like it's a waste of time.
Yeah, I agree. Is the person you hired or you're talking to, are they local?
Yeah, she is actually. You know, part of it was comfortability with that. And if I ever move, then that's fine. But, you know, I explained to her, I was like, look, I really want to get to a position where I can hand things to you and I don't ever actually have to see you. Because she was concerned. Well, not concerned, but she's like, oh, do you need me to come into your office? Do you need me to, you know, how many times a week do we need to meet? And I'm like, no. I don't ever actually want to see you.
Yeah, let's get this straight. I don't even have an office. You know, it's my basement in my house.
Right.
Yeah. No, I feel the same way. I actually have it on my post-MicroConf to-do list. I have 3 things, and one of them is hire a bookkeeper. And now I've since going to MicroConf, I've added a couple comments to that Trello item of hire a bookkeeper. I've heard that Xero, X-E-R-O, could potentially work for me. And then someone mentioned that I should try Less Accounting as well. I had tried both of them about 2.5-3 years ago, and they didn't work given my complexity of all the PayPal and bank accounts and merchant accounts and all that stuff that run through my company, the Numa Group. But now that I'm out looking again, I'll probably sign up for both of those guys and then also look into getting a bookkeeper and figure out which of the 3 approaches is going to work best for me.
I talked to several people at MicroConf who were using Outright as well, which we use internally.
Absolutely. Yeah, I use Outright. We have 2 Outright accounts. One is for our micropreneur stuff, and then .NET Invoice has its own Outright account. But the rest of my stuff is more complicated than Outright can easily handle. It's a pretty simple system, which is great, but it just can only support so much. And please, please don't post a comment and tell me to do QuickBooks Online or QuickBooks of any kind. If I need to use QuickBooks, if that really is the solution, then I'm definitely hiring a bookkeeper because I don't want to touch it. You know, I want them to handle all of the any interactions with QuickBooks is going to be handled by someone else.
Yeah, this bookkeeper that I'm working with, she primarily uses QuickBooks, which I'm not terribly pleased about it. But at the same time, if I'm not dealing with it, then I don't necessarily care a whole lot.
That's right.
You know, we'll see how it works out. And she actually has a relationship with a QuickBooks consultant. So anytime she has a question, she just goes talk to them and it's a friend of hers and just gets it all straightened out. So they're, you know, she might even be doing my payroll and maybe switching over from Paychex to have her do that as well.
Yeah, that'd be nice for sure. So, hey, last month I had a projection of what Hittail was going to do. I actually mentioned it in my MicroConf talk, and it actually grew by more than expected, like quite a bit more. And I realized that at the end of every month, like as the end of the month approaches, you know, you have projections in your dashboard that you're looking out. I've just found it so difficult to be accurate with those projections. Even with 4 days left in a month, I mean, I can be off by 20%, 30% of growth, not the 20% of revenue in the total month, because I know where my base is, but just the percentage of growth or loss that month. I just have not found a good way that I feel confident that I can say, yes, within, you know, $100, that's going to be the number. And the funny thing is, I thought it was just me and the data, the way it's stored in Hittail, but I've talked to several other people who own SaaS apps and software companies, and it feels like this is a recurring problem. Everyone I know has it. I have analysis apps, and I have Dig My Data, and I have a bunch of apps that I can run reports on and stuff, but there really isn't a great solution for it. I thought it was funny. I ran the numbers today, and I'm always a little bit surprised, and you just think at this point I would have this dialed in.
Is that because of the way that the months fall? So like, you know, some have 30 days, some have 31.
Sometimes it is. You know, other times you'll just get a chunk of cancer cancellations for some reason, just a little blip, and it's just enough that it kind of sends you, the growth is just a little smaller than you think. The reason I got the bigger bump, I don't know, I had some boost, I don't know if it was improved conversion rates or if I just had a lot of trials in the funnel that I just for the last couple of days of the month that I really hadn't counted on that suddenly converted. It was something to that effect. And so there's always these small anomalies. And again, it's not like, oh, I can't run my business because of this, but it's, I guess if you're out there and you're running a SaaS app and you're in the same boat, don't feel bad because everybody I talk to always has that thing of like, how, where really am I going to be at the end of this month?
I had a discussion this past week with my Audit Shark developer to finalize the list of things that needs to get done before we can really start pushing on it. It's really small at this point. I mean, the only two things that are left, I would say, are email reports and billing. And billing obviously doesn't necessarily need to be completely in place. But beyond that, those things are both things that he's taken care of. And then just expanding the policy file library. But other than that, I mean, everything looks like it's good to go. So next week, I'm going to be sitting down. I have the week off, or I took the week off, and I'm going to be sitting down and figuring out exactly who else I'm going to be putting into my beta program and trying to figure out exactly when I want to go live with a full public launch.
Very good. But at this point, you think you're within weeks?
Yeah, it's definitely weeks, definitely not months. Unless something major comes up that I didn't see or wasn't able to test, I don't see an issue with getting out there, you know, within next several weeks.
Right. Very cool. Yeah, I would encourage you to launch without billing in place. Obviously, as long as you're collecting a credit card or maybe even you don't need to collect the credit card if you're not going to collect it up front. But
no, I'm going to. I want to because until now, I haven't billed anybody for it yet. So next week, I want to get to the point where things are in place enough so that I could start billing people. And I intend to. There's a few minor pieces I need in place just to be able to put the credit card numbers in. But the final billing code is probably not going to be ready when I, you know, go through that process. I'll have my developer work on that while I'm going through it, though.
Right, definitely. Yeah, that's a nice part about having a developer. There, you know, there's a couple ways to do it, right? If you're writing all the code, then nothing gets done unless you're doing it. But there's also that, the hybrid where you're writing some of it and they're writing some of it. And it's nice because you can keep your hands in it and writing code is so much fun, right? But I find that that still weighs on me, that I would still assign a lot of the tasks that had to get done to me. And if I wanted to get them done quick, and then I just work till 1 or 2 in the morning to try to get a bunch done. Being able to outsource everything, essentially have someone else doing it, I find there's like a certain level of, it's actually, it relieves, I don't have the stress that I should be doing something right now because our critical path is held up by how fast the code can get written, but I'm not writing any code on this project. I'm talking about Drip now. You know, I know you've written code on Audit Shark. Are there tasks here that you could feasibly get done faster if you pulled some of them back to you, or is that it? Are you kind of done right now with writing the code and it's all outsourced to your dev?
There are definitely things that I could pull back and work on myself that would get done quicker because he's only working on it 2 days a week at this point. There's things that could definitely get done quicker if I'm working on them because I could obviously work on them 7 days a week. But at the same time, there are so many different things that need my attention. It's just not worth the time and effort. If I start focusing on the code at this point, I'm going to start dropping some of the other things. And all the other things are sales, marketing, you know, customer development related. So those are the things that really need to get done. And then the policy library is kind of a big chunk that I have not sunk my teeth into yet. I've really got to figure out how to get that built out as quickly as possible and put a process in place for somebody to kind of walk through and start implementing those things. And that's a key component right now that I just don't have a good handle on. So I'll be putting some time and effort into that next week just because it needs to get done and it needs to be something that expands over time. I can't just do a bunch of work there and then just walk away. There's other things that need to be built on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, and that makes sense. That's actually what I'm saying is like not getting dragged back into the code right now when all the marketing and sales and this other stuff needs to get done. There's a certain amount of serenity to it. That's what I was saying, is that having someone that I can hand off the code to and say, get it done as fast as possible, but not feeling the compulsion to go in and do it myself is better for the product in the long term. I mean, that actually leads it right into what's going on with Drip. As we record this podcast, we're in an hour or two of having all the features complete to install it on customer number one. And I had expected this to come late last week, but MicroConf just kind of trashed everything. And then when Derek and I met, he's the product manager for Hidtail and the developer on Drip, we went through some more features that we wanted to get in before we got customer one on. So my hope is that by the next time we record, I mean, realistically, it should be by tomorrow. customer one who I've already talked to should be installing it. I'm sure we'll run into a whole slew of other things, small features here and there that we need to add and tweak to get it ready for customer number two. What's cool is in FogBugs, I have milestones for each of the customers that I'm going to get on. There's this milestone of, it's called customer number one, and it has all the issues that I need fixed and that I think that he needs. I've already emailed him and asked him exactly what he's going to do with it. And so we had to add some things last minute to get it in, but it makes it really easy. It feels like it's slow going, but it makes it easy to know that when he gets in there, it should have everything he needs to basically do what he's doing today with his software.
That's a really interesting idea. I hadn't thought about creating milestones for each individual customer where they look at that and they say, oh, well, this isn't working for me, or I need something over here instead. That's a really good idea. I think I'll steal that.
And we are, I mean, it's not that we're giving them access to it. It's not that we're letting them know, oh, here's all the issues we're fixing, or here's all the things we're adding. It makes it easy to not be like, I'm launching to 500 people. We're really launching this week to one person. It's one guy who owns a SaaS app. I was able to interview him and say, exactly how are you going to use this? And he kind of said, gave me some ideas. I asked more questions, and then I realized, and you know, talked with Derek and said, all right, our app doesn't do these four things right now. We need to build this in order for it to support him. And knowing that his needs are common is helpful, right? It's not that he sent us off on a rabbit trail to do some random feature. The features that he needs, everyone's going to need. It's just about prioritizing them. We have a list of, say, 50 features right now, and I just picked the next four that we need to get him on the system, because once we have him on the system, we'll just start learning so much faster.
Cool. Yeah, I had a similar discussion with Jason Roberts from the TechSync podcast at MicroConf last week, and I was talking to him about his secret project and told him, I was like, you know, these are the things that I would need, and these are the things that I would use in that, and these are the pieces that are important to me. He's like, oh, well, I hadn't really thought about that, or, you know, and that wouldn't be too hard to add in, but it just kind of highlighted some of the things that are fairly common use scenarios that, you know, just hadn't really occurred to him.
Yeah, and that's always the way it is. We never quite realize how people are going to use our apps. So until someone's actually using it, and I dare say paying for it, although if they're very serious about it, even if they haven't paid you a dime, if it's the right people who really know, you know, who build apps themselves, they can often get you good feedback even without giving you the money. But I think the ideal case is that until you have someone using it and paying you for it, you just don't know how folks are going to be utilizing it.
So one of our listeners, his name's Masej from Fired Up Digital. He started listening around episode 22 and has since left his job. He dropped us a few more productivity tips related to episode 125. The two tips that he sent into us was, the first one was to split the day, do email and stuff like that in the morning, and then work in the afternoon in a coffee shop so that you're not doing the same thing all day long in one location. And then the second thing he said was that, you know, he exercises regularly to get some of the endorphins going, and just recently done a marathon. But both of those, I think, are really good tips that fit in with episode 125. So today we're talking about 7 steps to rescuing a failing software project. And this idea is really about, if you have a project that you're working on, whether it's in-house development or you're working on a product itself that you're going to be launching out to the world, and things are starting to go wrong, you know, whether the code isn't getting done fast enough, there's people who aren't responding when you ask them for things, and you know, you're trying to manage the project, but at the same time there's just lots of stuff going on that, you know, you're not quite sure how to handle, or those things are going off the rails a little bit. You need to be able to get things back on track. So this episode is really about stepping in, kind of assessing the situation, and then rescuing in that project, put it back on track.
And this applies both to being having a pre-launch product, as well as maybe you're going from version 2.0 to version 2.4, and you have a bunch of tasks that you're trying to do. Maybe you're working with developers, and like you said, things aren't working out.
So step one is to don't assign blame. If you start assigning blame to people, they're going to, you know, at least be a little bit resentful. Some things are beyond their control. Maybe you haven't given them enough direction. Maybe they're waiting for other people. The point here is that by assigning blame, you're essentially pointing fingers, and they're going to resent that. What you really need to do is you need to step back. You need to figure out what's going on and address the underlying reasons why things are starting to go wrong. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, if somebody is willfully ignoring you or they're just not doing what you're telling them to do, you know, obviously you need to address that. But in a general sense, you don't want to kind of bring everybody together as a group and say, hey, look, Joe over there, you're not doing your stuff. This stuff has got to get done, you know, and all these other people are counting on you, but you're just, you know, you're not coming through for us. We need you to, you know, get on things. The other thing that goes along with this is not doing it publicly either. I mean, if you do need to provide some critical feedback to people because they are in that type of situation, definitely do it privately. You don't want to make a big deal out of it in front of everybody because that will push them away instead of bring them into the fold.
The best example I've seen of this, of a manager who handled this kind of stuff really well, where mistakes were made, and he wanted the entire team to learn about something. Because if you think about it, like, mistakes are opportunities for learning, right? A mistake would be made, he would correct that person privately, just like you said, and then he'd bring the team together and he would try to anonymize it, right? And say like, hey guys, this just happened. And in any way he could, if he could anonymize it, he would just say, this just happened. Here's what we're going to do to correct it. Here's why we don't do that. You know, here's the remedy for it so that we all don't make it in the future. And if he couldn't anonymize it, he would say exactly what I just said. He'd say, look, John here did this. He and I just talked about it. It was a mistake. But the reason I'm bringing this up is not to shame him. It's that all of us need to learn from this. Like, this is a learning experience. He would actually use it as a kind of a teaching moment so everybody was feeling okay about it. And then, you know, as the project went on, like, it wasn't a guilty thing where you felt like a mistake was this bad thing, right? It was rather than assigning blame, it was used as kind of a learning thing to help improve everyone, help improve the team dynamics, and just help move the project forward.
Step number two is to look at the numbers. Is it time to pull the plug? And you need to be able to make an honest assessment as to whether or not the project can be salvaged. If there are definite milestones that you need to reach, if it's an outsourced project to you or your customers are coming in saying, hey, we need this by this particular date, look at those numbers, any timelines that you have, try and figure out honestly where exactly things stand. I mean, you have to be realistic about everything. Because if you can't, then it makes it very difficult to plan for the future. You need to be able to be honest with yourself, be honest with your team, and ask people, you know, do you think this project can be saved? And by asking everybody, you get different people's feedback on that. And it's really important to not just depend on your own optimism or pessimism, as the case may be. Ask everybody on your team and let them know, this is where things stand. Do you think this project can be saved under these parameters?
This is such a hard question to answer because it's such a case-by-case basis thing. A lot of it depends on trusting your own gut and looking at a project and really asking some tough questions. Shutting a project down it always feels so painful, right? Because you've invested time, money, resources, everything into a project, whether it's months old or even if it's just a few weeks old. But at the same time, there's that expression, sending good money after bad. I'm actually a little bit dealing with this right now on a project dealing with Hitel. It's not a development project, but I hired a contractor to help out with something. We're about 3 months into it, and it's not moving as fast as I would have wanted, but the contractor's been really good about communicating with me and really good about pointing out, you know, roadblocks and bumps along the way. So there's that thing of like, if they just don't communicate, then yes, it's obvious it's not going to work out. But he's always one step away from delivering something. So I'm in the place of like, I had asked myself this morning, I was on a call with him and I said, you know, is it time to pull the plug on this? Can it be salvaged? And so I brought that up to him and I said, hey, here's how I'm feeling. I'm feeling right now like we're 3 months into this and I'm not sure that you're going to be able to deliver on this. And here's what I need. I need to feel confident that the next thing you do, you'll hit the deadline and you're going to deliver at the level that I need. And it actually turned out to be a really good conversation. And I appreciated it. He was very professional about it. And now we have a hard deadline with like an exact milestone that happens in a couple weeks. And we both agreed, you know, if it doesn't work out at that point, we're just going to walk away. And he's actually going to refund all the money that I paid him. I don't know. It was just a worthwhile thing. So that's, I've found, especially lately, it's like if a contractor is either unprofessional or unreliable, or an employee for that matter, then that tends to be, you know, a better reason to pull the plug. But if they're willing to work with you and like commit to things and get them done, and they actually do start delivering, then a lot of things can be salvaged even when maybe you think they can't.
The third step is to stop looking at the software you're building. A lot of times, if a software development project starts to go off the rails a little bit, people will look at the software and say, well, why are these things not getting done? You know, what is it in the software that's so complicated? And they start digging in, and they tend to go down the rabbit hole. The problem is the software is probably not to blame. It's the management of the project. It is the deadlines that you're putting in place and the time estimates that you're putting into those. I mean, if those things are being created in such a way that it is unrealistic to even be able to come up with those time estimates, then that's the issue that needs to be addressed. It's not building the software that's the problem. It's the time estimates that you're associating with it. You really need to assess where things are going wrong and deal with those issues rather than just assuming that the problem is in writing of the code.
Moving from developer to product manager is hard. You know, a lot of developers don't estimate how long it's going to take them to do something, and they want to move ahead with the fun stuff, which is the coding, the building, and the creating. And I totally get that. That's how I am built by nature. And so if a project is going off the rails, the first place I look at, obviously, is the project manager, because he or she's the one responsible. But more importantly, I start looking at, like, well, where are your estimates? And how close or how far off have you been from those? And figuring out either that you're a bad estimator, or that, you know, that you miss pieces of the estimate, somehow taking away, like, realize this is probably a mistake on your part, and learning from that so that you don't do it next time is extremely valuable, as opposed to just ignoring it, or, like you said, you know, blaming it on the software, blaming it was too technically hard, or I didn't do estimates because I just wanted to have fun building. And it's like, none of that is helpful. If you actually do want to get better and improve at this whole project management thing, or just even at building software products, you have to sit there and examine the process and figure out where you went wrong and improve yourself.
Yeah, that's something that I have to personally take a little bit stronger look at, just because we haven't really put a lot of time estimates into AutoShark. I mean, there's certain places where there are, but there's a lot of places, a lot of things in FogBugs where there are not time estimates, which makes it hard to do scheduling and trying to figure out where different dates are going to fall. So that's definitely something I need to get better at on my end. But I think that that's a common problem too.
I sometimes feel like a broken record, because every time I talk to one of my developers and we talk about doing a new feature, the first thing I say is, all right, I need an estimate on that. And you don't have to give it to me right now. You can think about it for 5 minutes and send me an email, put it directly in FogBugs or the Google Doc we have set up. But I need, before you write a line of code, I need an estimate so that we have some idea of how long this is going to take. And the thing is if you get 20 or 30 small little features, you know, all in your issue tracking system, it's impossible to know. It's impossible to estimate how long that's going to take, especially when someone's not working full time. That's where it gets weird, right? If they're working 16 or 20 hours in a week, then things get kind of hairy. I think all of us learn, if you've been developing, you know, writing code for 20 years, you think in terms of person weeks. And so if they're only working 15, 20 hours a week, I find it really hard to just look at a swath of things and say, oh, this is going to take them X amount of weeks, because you don't have in mind that they're only working, you know, part time. And so having those actual hour estimates, even if they're off by 10 or 20%, it really makes it a lot clearer as to when potentially you could deliver the thing.
So step four is to cut twice and then cut again. And this is really in reference to feature creep, because feature creep is real. It bogs down a project. There's always new things to be implemented. There's always new features that are coming in, whether they're from customers or from project management, which tends to be you. But you have to be able to make the project manageable and make the milestones manageable by cutting things out that are just unnecessary.
This is where I've become a pretty big believer in this whole early access model. As we've been building Drip, I have been looking at just the minimum feature set we needed to get it installed on Hittail. And whenever we had a question or a decision to make about should we implement that, I asked Eric and I said, do we need that to install on Hittail? And then we'd say yes or no, and that would go into the Hittail milestone, the customer zero milestone we had. And as soon as we got on Hittail, yay, big celebration. And even that took way longer than we wanted to, right? Or than we thought, which it always does. Then we said, okay, what are we going to do next? And that's when I interviewed customer one, looked at exactly what he needed that we didn't have. And everything since then that we've discovered, you know, the other 5 to 10 things we found on our own, we've asked the question, does he need these to launch? Because if he doesn't, then don't put it in this milestone yet. Put it in customer two, or even way down the line, we have like a public launch milestone in FogBugs. And so that's the one that we need before everybody gets in. So that's things like setting a settings page and updating your password and all the billing stuff. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's not in place at this point. It is absolutely, you know, about as much of an MVP as we could do and feel reasonable about. No matter how much you do that, it's still going to take longer than you think. You can only cut so far, and being able to focus on a handful of customers up front and just building for them makes it much easier to prioritize than if you're just picking things out of the air and trying to decide yes or no, should we build this? Because the answer is always yes, we should build this. But the question is, when should we build it? How soon should we build it? Can we push this off one more milestone down the line? Can we push it off to public launch, or maybe to 1.1, which is after public launch, when you have that revenue coming in and you have the motivation and the excitement of having customers paying you, the payoff of all that, because that'll be the time where you can really hunker down and potentially hire more developers if you have more revenue. Pushing things off past that is really a benefit to a bootstrap product.
Step 5 is to be honest about your project risks. Anytime there's a dependency on something, when things go wrong, it's going to push everything back. And this is one of the fundamental problems with the waterfall method that Agile and Scrum have tried to solve. But if you're not honest about the project risks, and the project risk can be any sort of dependencies that you have, whether they're on software or people or availability of resources, new hardware coming out, new software releases. So if you're waiting for the next version of Windows or the next kernel Linux to become available, those things are probably beyond your control. You don't have any say in when those things actually occur. And although you may get commitments from people, they're not necessarily set in stone, and they can decide, oh, well, we're going to push this back because of X, Y, and Z, and they may very well be legitimate reasons. But because they're outside of your control, you have to take that as a risk and take into account what you're going to do if those things don't come through.
Yeah, an element of a project having risk or not, really, it isn't a binary thing, right? It's not a yes or no. It's more of a gradient. But in my project plans, I always just have a yes or no, because most things you're doing as you're writing code have very little risk. Because if you're inserting data into a database, validating it, pulling it out and displaying it, like, these are virtually zero risk. But the thing, anytime you're integrating with an external API or you're doing any type of algorithm that needs to do kind of some magic that you're going to have to play around with, or any type of external dealing with third parties that you have to rely on in some form or fashion, those things are all, in my opinion, the risk is just through the roof. There's a big risk of running over your estimate more than anything. There's always a risk that you're never going to get it done, you know, that it's just not going to work or not going to do your thing. But that's a lower risk than you're just going to be 50 or 100% over your estimate. So when I have project plans, if it's in a Google Doc, I'll put a big like risk column and then say, yes, this part right here, I'm really sketchy about. I just don't know if we're going to be able to deliver this. I want to build that first. Like, I want to eliminate the risk as soon as possible in a project. And that tends to be the opposite of the natural inclination, which is to push all the risky stuff off to the end and do the easy stuff first. So if you're attacking a project and you don't want it to get to the point where it's becoming a failing project, try to stack up the hard things first, the tricky things first, and build them before everything else. Because we know that you can write billing code, and we know that you can build a settings page where people can reset their password. That's the trivial part. It's doing the hard stuff first that's, you know, going to hopefully ensure the success of your project.
I think the biggest thing I run into in those types of things is kind of what you alluded to, was like third-party libraries and third-party integrations, any external APIs, because you can always run into a bug in those, or, you know, if it's an open source project, you may have to resort to reading the source code to figure out exactly how it works and be able to do what it is that you need to do. Step 6 is to intervene when necessary. There are times when you're going to have to make hard decisions or accept some technical debt now to get a project out the door. You may also need to overrule the opinions of some of your developers. Some of the more extreme cases, you may need to cut people out of the project or bring in new ones. But the fact of the matter is that this is your business, and you're the one who has to make those hard decisions. Nobody else can make them for you. And you do have to take into account all the previous things that, you know, we've talked about so far in this podcast episode. You have to be willing to intervene when it's absolutely necessary and make those decisions.
And this counts both for when you've hired a developer or when you're writing the code yourself. And that's the hard part that I think most people don't think about, is that just because you're the project manager and the developer doesn't mean you shouldn't have some type of mental separation between those hats. Because making the call to not implement something that the developer side really wants to implement because it's either going to be fun, or you know it's easy, or you know you can do it in quote unquote just a few hours, if it's not going to get you closer to launch and closer to having people getting value out of your app and paying you money, then that's the time to step in and say, we need to push this off.
And the seventh and final step is to fix your processes and procedures. You need to document things, figure out how things went wrong, and figure out how to do them better in the future. You want to be able to avoid repeated problems from one project to the next, and use each project as a learning experience to be able to take those experiences and those good lessons that you've learned and apply them to the next project so that things will run smoother the next time around. This applies whether or not you've got a single product and you're just trying to get multiple releases out the door, or you're trying to build multiple products and sell each of them independently and build a small company that, you know, manages multiple products.
You know, I hate processes and I despise procedures, but sometimes they're required so that you don't make the same mistakes over and over. When I really like processes and procedures is when they make my life easier in the future, when they allow me to essentially hand something off to someone else so that it can be done right over and over and over, and thereby leveraging someone else's time instead of mine, and when it saves me from losing time or money or just making a big mistake in the future. You know, it's kind of the entrepreneurial go with your gut as to how much you need, but for sure, if you're a one-person shop, you don't need very many. But as you grow, even if you only grow with part-time contractors or, you know, getting into some full-time contractors, you need to start ramping it up just a little bit, just enough so that you can hand stuff off with confidence and not be bogged down by handling all of the processes. And then so you can learn from your mistakes and be, you know, more successful in the future and more efficient moving forward.
And don't forget that that includes documenting things as well, because just because you wrote the code for something doesn't mean that somebody else is going to be able to understand it or is going to know intuitively exactly how to use it. So make sure that you put together documentation, not just about your code, but around, you know, for example, your build process. If you have a complicated build setup, make sure you document that so that even if you're rebuilding your machine and going from one machine to the next, you know how that is supposed to work and you can hand that off to a developer. The same thing goes with some of your marketing collateral or anything else. But I mean, we've kind of talked about a lot of these things in the past in terms of documenting all the different procedures that you use in your business so that you can outsource them. And that's part of what this entails as well.
So to recap, our seven steps to rescuing a failing software project are: don't assign blame. Number two, look at the numbers. Number three, stop looking at the software you're building. Number four, cut twice, then cut again. Number five, be honest about your project risks. Number six, intervene when necessary. And number seven, fix your processes and procedures.
If you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.